Radio section of the 24th Division Information Office is to supply the broadcasting media with a continuous flow of news on the activities of the thousands of men who make up the 24th. One of our main products is the weekly 24th Division Showcase heard on AFN Munich.
From the island of Leyte, the rocky hills of Korea, to the mountains of Bavaria, proudly waves the banner of the 24th Infantry Division. This is the Victory Division Showcase.
We make the most of the advantages we have over the printed word, timeliness, and the radio's ability to record the action as it happens.
The biggest sound heard on the foothills of Graffenwehr is that of the Honest John rocket.
3, 2, 1, 0.
It's our purpose with the feature material we produce to get the actual words of the men who make up this division and show the soldier on the job. As an example, here we are meeting a new replacement at the Augsburg Hauptbahnhof.
Welcome to Germany, soldier.
How was the trip down?
I just loved it. On the ship Geiger, it was just fine. I got a stop in Spain also. I had a very fine time. I worked as a barber on the ship coming over. It was a very fine time, and I loved it.
Another example, a program concerning the story of nighttime operations in the 24th Division.
Throughout the hours of darkness, the division communications are fully alive. We're here at division headquarters, the nerve center of this always wakeful system.
This is Sergeant First Class Roberts, 24th Infantry Division, Staff Duty NCO. This is a communications check.
Here we are visiting the division's non-commissioned officers' academy.
It is very difficult to some men who have never given drill. They make on-the-spot corrections are made, and this is a very effective way. Learn by doing.
Here we are with the story of our division's units serving in Berlin.
The first move, the second of the 34th to Berlin, was made in October. Turning back now to this big moment, this was Alan Chartel of AFN Berlin on the checkpoint.
Right now, the trucks are coming by here at the Babelsberg checkpoint. The first element of the 2nd Battalion, 34th Infantry, coming in from Augsburg for a stay here in West Berlin. A number of officers are gathered around us here. The first contingent has gone by, and as you can hear in the background, the band is playing.
On the showcase, we present the very real talent of enlisted men in this division.
Told me where to call my home. When I was just a little lad, I began to roam. When I heard the musket fire ringing loud and clear, saw the redcoats up at Tarrytown, I had to volunteer.
We'll sing another song, then we've got to move along. Far away, myself. Please try to understand why I'm leaving you, Suzanne. Like the wind, we're heading for the hill.
We've covered the cooperation we have with the Air Force's close air support missions.
The sound of an airstrike. On the flight line, a technician gets one of the terror men into his rear seat. This briefing is no simple thing.
All right, sir. Over here is your oxygen regulator and system. The only thing you'll be touching is this white switch. On takeoffs and landings, you'll have it in the forward position 100% on. Anytime you feel queasy, put it in that position, make you feel like a new man.
This has been the Victory Division Showcase, produced through the facilities of the American Forces Network Munich by the 24th Infantry Division Information Office.
The intention of this much-listened-to program, like the daily news reports and network feature material we produce, is to increase the pride each man has in his division and make that patch he wears on his shoulder that much more meaningful.
Slug. This shot to AFN Frankfurt. Special events from AFN Munich, Army PFC Bob Rohn of the 24th Division, an approximate 4 minute and 45 second aspect feature for this Saturday's Weekend World. This concerns the ceremony today being given the Oberbürgermeister of Augsburg as he's presented the Department of the Army's highest civilian award, the Distinguished Civilian Service Medal. Shot begins in 5 seconds. Jim, in this 2,000-year-old Bavarian city of Augsburg, Germany this afternoon, the United States Army holds a surprise in store for the man who has led Augsburg through the past 17 years. At this moment, before the famous Rathaus, an American color guard is assembling with officials of the 24th Infantry Division to pay a unique honor to Augsburg's retiring Oberbürgermeister. Dr. Klaus Müller will shortly be the first German to receive the Department of the Army's highest civilian award, the Distinguished Civilian Service Medal. At 72 years of age, this gentleman has represented a spirit of progress and cooperation to a great number of Germans and Americans in this area to the north of Munich. It was under the auspices of the Augsburg headquartered 24th Division and its commander, Major General W.A. Cunningham, that Dr. Müller was recommended for the medal. The Department of the Army and the State Department certified the honor in Washington. Herr Dr. Klaus Müller's beginnings as a community leader were inauspicious. He was the son of the Augsburg Army Regiment's cobbler. He was born the third of seven children in 1892 in Augsburg. At the age of 22, he graduated with a doctorate, magna cum laude, from the University of Munich. As an Oberleutnant in World War I, Klaus Müller had his first meeting with the Americans. He was wounded in the leg while serving on the Western Front. After the war, he entered one of the great Augsburg textile companies and eventually became an executive. There was a limited interest in politics in the 20s when he joined a middle-of-the-road regional party. In the Second World War, his wounds kept him on the home front as a major in the defense system. It was in the days immediately following World War II that the United States government first found Dr. Müller as a capable custodian for various Augsburg factories. His ability in difficult times was such that the city council appointed him mayor of the city, first in 1947 and then in 1949. Upon the reestablishment of the Federal German Republic in 1952, the population here verified the faith the city council has placed in the Lord Mayor. Dr. Müller has been re-elected for 2 6-year terms by the people of Augsburg. It's Dr. Müller's continuing awareness of the American population here which brings him the laurels he'll receive today. In the immediate post-war era, his weekly visits as industrial liaison to the American military commander in Augsburg later evolved into trips by the commander to Dr. Müller's office. Actively interested in the welfare of 20,000 Americans in his city, he founded the German-American Advisory Council in 1952. American soldiers here don't feel so far from home at Christmas time thanks to his and the council's efforts. Each year, hundreds of soldiers are invited for a German Christmas in Augsburg homes. So, too, the mayor has seen German orphans get a sample of American Thanksgiving, and under his administration, America has instituted the Easter sunrise service into the German celebration of that feast. In June of the past year, the Augsburg American High School, at the invitation of the Lord Mayor, held their graduation exercises in the magnificent Baroque Goldener Saal at City Hall. To no one's surprise, the mayor was in attendance and personally presented diplomas and gifts to the graduates. But here in Augsburg, it is perhaps most typically at Dr. Müller's German-American Advisory Council meetings that the mutual problems and ideas of the two communities are aired, discussed, and solved. In hopes of responding to the mayor's spirit of friendship, he has become the only honorary civilian member of the 24th Infantry Division and was the first to receive the new division award, the Order of the Lion. The doctor once gave staff officers of this division a vivid example of his tireless efforts. Last May, the 72-year-old former infantry officer gave the staff members a rugged half-day tour of the city's medieval fortifications, climbing over battlements and racing up walkways well ahead of his American friends. Today, in the city square, the playing of the American National Anthem by a Bundeswehr band and of the German anthem by the 24th Division Band will perhaps be representative of the understanding and cooperation which have led to the mayor's receiving this important award. Next week, Dr. Klaus Müller retires from the office he has held longer than any other mayor in Bavaria. he'll be taking with him the thanks of his good friends in Augsburg, as well as the highest civilian award the Department of the Army can bestow. This is Army PFC Bob Rowan of the 24th Division Information Office in Augsburg, reporting for Aspect and returning you to Weekend World.
From the island of Leyte, the rocky hills of Korea, to the mountains of Bavaria, proudly waves the banner of the 24th Infantry Division. This is the Victory Division Showcase. Tonight we turn our eyes and ears skyward as we bring you a special program on the tactical air operation which recently took place in the Libyan desert. Army PFC Bob Rowan gives the report on these operations tonight on your Victory Division Showcase. Sounds are intertwined with those of an infantry division on the move. Tactical airstrikes to soften up, pave the way, rout out the enemy. So important is this sound that every unit in the Victory Division is ready and able to coordinate airstrikes for their outfits in action. The key man is the S-34 Air. It was a current trip to North Africa which gave a group of S-3s for air an unforgettable picture of how the Air Force supports the man on the ground. Where did tactical air support begin? Here's the Air Force liaison officer to the 24th Infantry Division, Captain Cliff Hoy, with PFC Ed Laubach.
Close air support was used to a limited degree during World War II. It was primarily used by 9th Tactical Air Support units crossing through France, and limitedly used by the 8th Air Force. It was extensively augmented or extensively used during the Korean conflict.
Can you further define the air-ground operation system?
Really, in a nutshell, the air-ground operation system consists of providing tactical air support to ground forces. Specifically, the Army and the Air Force have joined together in the operation of a joint air-ground operations system.
Here's a forward air controller, Captain Bill Sparks, to tell what he does.
In a combat situation, we form a very mobile team, move out into the area in which a strike is requested, and control the aircraft coming in. We have radios capable of being in contact with the battalion, with the air liaison officer and his net, and with the forward air control post, the radars, which direct the aircraft in. We set up in an advantageous position, brief the aircraft coming in, direct them into the target, mainly to protect friendly troops and to give maximum firepower on enemy forces.
That sets the stage. Now, here's the story. South of Tripoli, the North African desert, here is the Air Force's gunnery range and Wheelis Air Base. 8 officers of the division, S-3s for air, and military intelligence officers are on the spot. Here was heard the sound of the Super Sabre, the F-100 flying at 1.5 times the speed of sound. Before takeoff, the visitors were in the Wheelis briefing shack. They were struck by one thing about these pilots: the calm and relaxed manner in which they talked about flying at supersonic speeds.
We've covered the majority of the flight briefing to get us out to the range, and right now we're just orbiting over the little spot we call the wells out there. Here's the basic picture on the thing. Here's Tripoli, here's a base. What we're gonna do is take off and do a right and a left turn like this, and we go through this corridor here. This is an airway corridor at 3,000 feet. Then we'll climb up to 10,000 feet and head out here to what we call a cotton patch. It's just a big, pretty beach out there that we join up on. Little town of Zawaro here. And we'll turn and go down to the range here. And these are the wells. And we'll make a couple orbits here, depending on how long it takes us to get there and if we're able to take off right on time and a few delays we might have. As we turn down, I'll try not to go over about 400 knots so you can double-check your trim.
On the flight line, a technician gets one of the Terra men into his rear seat. This briefing is no simple thing.
All right, sir, over here is your oxygen regulator and system. The only thing you'll be touching is this white switch. On takeoffs and landings, you'll have it in the forward position 100% on. Anytime you feel queasy, put it in that position, make you feel like a new man. On this side here, you have the inertia reel. This is what's going to be locking your shoulders back. You can have it in the back position so you can come forward, move around as freely as you want. On your maneuvers, on takeoffs and landings, have this in the forward position so it'll lock you in position so if you have any sudden jerk, it won't knock you off.
Okay.
Underneath the throttle here, you have a button. It's a call button. If you have any interference where he can't hear you, just put your finger down there and it cuts everybody else except you and him, and he can hear you as clear as day. Anytime they have a channel change where he says, you know, come to channel 17 or channel 14, this is your channel selector here. You can do whatever you want. So you can hear everybody, and your volume control for your outside communications. Now right here is your altimeter. You'll be flying about 12,000, between 10 and 12,000 feet out to the range. Here is your airspeed indicator in hundreds of knots. This over here is your number of G's that you'll be pulling, positive or negative. You'll be pulling mostly positive G's. Here is your angle of climb. Where is that? There it is. Angle of climb. This is your artificial horizon. This is what you'll be following if he asks you to let your fly. You just have to follow this, keep it straight and level, and be all set. Your two fire warning lights. If you see these come on at any time, let him know.
Okay.
If he has to blow the canopy for any reason, but yet you're going to still stay in the aircraft, pull this red button right here. This here lets this wind blast shield up in front of you to protect you in case of wind blast. Any questions, sir?
And now the strike itself. Ed Laubach caught one of the pilots, a calm, alert, enthusiastic young officer, and found out about his flying and why he flies.
We're speaking now with Air Force Lieutenant Don Madonna, one of the pilots who are flying our S-3 Airs from the 24th Division. Lieutenant Madonna, how often do you fly missions of this nature?
Not often enough. We have to get a minimum of 6 conventional delivery missions every 6 months period, so we get a minimum of about 12 a year. And occasionally, we'll luck out and get a couple extras. These are fun missions, and in addition to being a tremendous training quality, we have a heck of a good time on them. This is the real essence of being a fighter pilot. This and ACM, air combat maneuvering, two things that are the most fun of anything we do.
Would you tell us how you became interested or how you became a pilot?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I've wanted to fly. I've always enjoyed being around airplanes. I never really had anything to do with flying until I was, late in my high school. I had one ride in a little light airplane. And when I went to school, I got to fly a little bit more and enjoyed it. It just always seemed like kind of a dream world to me, and it still does.
There was big noise on the ranges. Here's where the pilots qualify with their aircraft the way a soldier qualifies with his M-14. Here's Ed Laubach with the Air Force range officer.
Well, when they are practicing the special weapons, rockets, and dive bombing, we run a system of optical triangulation on a target here, which you can see off to our left about 5,000 feet. Then go into a board and compute actually where the bomb or rocket hit. For strafing, the aircraft fire colored ammunition into a canvas target, and as the bullet goes through the target, it'll leave a marked hole in there. For instance, an aircraft may know that he's firing yellow ammunition. When the target gets back to base, he'll get this target out, lie it flat on the ground, and see how many yellow holes are in there. We can tell just how many bullets he's put through. From this, we compute a percentage of how many bullets he's fired. Skip bombing, of course, as these airplanes are doing now, you can actually see the bomb hit the target and either call it a hit or a miss. This is a relatively simple operation.
For the Terra men, there was no mistaking the impression this vivid picture of tactical air support made on them.
We're speaking now with a 24th Division S-3 Air Officer, Lieutenant Ernest Rotter. Lieutenant Rotter, what unit are you with?
I'm presently with the 2nd Battalion, 19th Infantry, at Gabligan Concern.
Could you tell us what you thought of your ride in the F-100?
Well, the ride itself is very interesting, and it's a new experience for me. However, when you're not accustomed to such a ride, you do have a tendency to feel a little sick when you are moving at the supersonic speeds.
Well, the purpose of the ride certainly wasn't for pleasure. It was to demonstrate something to you. What was the value of the ride?
Well, as an Army officer, we are mainly interested in the capabilities of the Air Force to support us in our ground maneuvers. And riding in a high-performance aircraft, such as I did yesterday, I can see how this aircraft can really support us if and when we need the support.
Have you participated in any exercises back in Germany?
Last time we were in Hohenfels, on our Army training tests, I had the opportunity to actually see a flight of aircraft in there while it was attacking my ammunition supply train. And believe me, I wouldn't want to be out there in an actual situation.
This, then, is the story of a mighty exhibition of air support as it was told on the Libyan desert. But for the men who went, there was time for another side, time for a land which has changed little in 1,000 years.
We saw the lights of the city shining out across the bay. Tripoli, as you know, is a seaport. This was quite a beautiful impression. That, together with the palm trees in the background against the skyline, creates a very beautiful sight.
PFC's Bill Seekamp and Ed Laubach represented the 24th Division Information Office on this journey to Tripoli. Here are excerpts of Stan Rabinowitz's talk with them.
The city itself is perhaps best described as being somewhat mysterious. You find a labyrinth of small winding streets which seem to go without any plan or arrangement through the old section of town. Coming in from the Sahara Desert in a truck, I was fortunate enough to see wandering Arabs on camels, and this was like something I had seen in picture books and movies before. It was quite an exciting thing.
How about the architecture of the city itself? How would you describe that, Ed?
Well, the architecture, I would say, is the same as it has been for years and years, like you would see in religious books of Jerusalem and Israel and other cities in the Middle East. And hardly anything has changed. Everything is about the same.
We visited on our tour Sunday one castle, which is centrally located in Tripoli, which was built by the Turks a very long time ago. And this castle displayed a Turkish influence in the architecture of it. And we were told that in the dungeon of this castle, 5 United States naval officers were kept during the conflict between the United States and the Barbary pirates of Tripoli. They had been captured off a United States naval vessel, which was stuck in Tripoli's harbor.
In a land as old as time, ultra-modern jets streak through the sky, showing their ability to reinforce the Victory Division Terror Man on his mission.
This has been the Victory Division Showcase, produced through the facilities of the American Forces Network Munich by the 24th Infantry Division Information Office. From the island of Leyte, the rocky hills of Korea, to the mountains of Bavaria, proudly waves the banner of the 24th Infantry Division. This is the Victory Division Showcase.
This week, the story of the grandeur, the might, and the beauty of a former world capital. A portrait of the headquarters city of the 24th Division.
21 centuries ago, the leaders of the greatest country in the world were faced with a decision.
On the northern flank of their world empire, marauding tribes threatened to push through their military strongholds in the Alps.
The decision, counterattack. Push the front north into the aggressor's territory.
The Roman Emperor Augustus chose his own brother-in-law, a general, to do the job. 10,000 soldiers of the Imperial Legions moved on to the Danube.
There they established a line of defense which, together with the Rhine River, contained the aggressors from the east for four centuries.
As the soldiers held their watch on the Danube, engineers from Rome began work on the Via Claudia, a road to stretch from the center of the empire to the northern outposts.
Up the Via Claudia poured all of Rome's wealth and civilization. At the same time, a town began to grow at the top of this highway. As the major point in Romanized Germany, it grew and prospered even after the Roman Empire passed on. By medieval times, when you talked about world capitals, you talked about Venice, Florence, Rome, Paris, and the city of Augsburg. Today, Augsburg is a city of 200,000, 45 miles to the north of what is today the dominant city in Bavaria, Munich. But the splendors of Augsburg's medieval and Renaissance days remain. On gathering material, the first stop was the tourist office on the busy Königsplatz. Checking through her books, tourist aide Frau Helmut Heuser came up with this summary of the city's 2,000 years.
Well, Augsburg was founded 15 years before Christ by the Roman general Drusus under his emperor Augustus. General Drusus gave the town the name of the Emperor Augusta Vindelicorum. When the Roman Empire broke down, the big emigration of the people began. From the 6th until the 12th century, Augsburg was the seat of the bishop, and from 1272 until 1806, it was a free city. 1806, Napoleon personally came by Augsburg and have united Swabia, including Augsburg, into the Kingdom Bavaria.
Part of the old Roman road, the Via Claudia, today forms the wide cobblestoned main street of Augsburg, Maximilianstrasse. From an apartment which overlooks this street, we visited with Frau Elsa Christ, a charming lady whose living room is filled with pictures and books of old Augsburg. It was here we found out about the family which dominated the city in its earlier days. The Fuggers were so rich, having earned profits of up to 150% on the Venetian spice trade, that the Austrian Emperor Charles V once owed the family 4 million marks. Frau Christ told us about this family and its origins.
I would start with the first who came to Augsburg, 1368. He married a daughter of an Augsburg master and could by this become a master himself. And his second wife brought him a big fortune, so he no longer was a weaver, he was a wholesaler. And when he died, he left his two sons a fortune from, according to the currency of 1914, were 120,000 marks. So his two sons also were wholesaler. And his great son, Jacob the Younger, who wanted to be a priest, but had to come to the firm after the death of four of his brothers. He was sent to Italy as an apprentice and gained there so big knowledge that he, when he came back to the firm, he was soon leading.
The old city holds unfathomable charm for many people. The Fuggers lavished such great sums on buildings, monuments, and fountains that it was the German president of the German-American Women's Club who reflected on her love for Augsburg and on the Fugger family's establishment of the oldest social settlement in the world, the Fuggeri.
I myself was born in England before World War I. Through World War I, my mother and my father returned to Germany, and there I have spent the best part of my life, especially in the city of Augsburg.
Frau Huber, what has happened to the Fuggers since the Renaissance?
They still are a most prominent and most wealthy family. And what their forefathers did for this town, they have done in their way after the war again. When the Fugarai was badly damaged, they, from their own funds, not only reconstructed the former houses, but also added some more ground to the Fugarai and extended it. And the great thing, I think, is that up to this day, the people can live in these houses in the Fugarai at the same charge the ancestors, the founders of the Fugarai, charged, which is a Dutch guilder.
42 cents a year in the fine medieval homes just below the Augsburg City Hall, the Fugger family's great social experiment, 400 years old. Outside the Cathedral of St. Ulrich's, we met its rector, Monsignor Stoll. Close by the busy traffic, these interiors are 1,000 years old.
Soldiers bring us always new things. The American soldiers, like the Roman soldiers, they brought us also the Christian faith to Augsburg. Also the time of persecution during the Emperor Diocletian, for instance, who was persecuting the Christian people, found also a victim in Augsburg in 304. Afra, that was a wife, not a man. She was martyred because of her faith and burned on an island of the River Lech. When we go around now the cathedral, you see all the old buildings round the churches. In the back, where the government of Schwaben is now, that was formerly the residence of the bishop. And you find a wonderful tower, the watchtower, where the people was looking for the bishop when he arrived with his horses. And in this corner, there is a little table, and there is written, in this hall took place in 1530 the Confessio Augustana,
which brought religious tolerance.
Yeah,
to
you
Germany.
Know, we had in Middle Ages, we are now in the Middle Age time, as Luther was coming to Augsburg and Cajetan, the cardinal, was over there, there was a discussion between Luther and Cardinal Cajetan. Luther went away, he was living in St. Anna, he fled away. And then in 1530, the Confessio Augustana took place. That means we live together as brethren and sisters.
Inside the cathedral, Monsignor Stoll shows us one of Augsburg's greatest treasures.
Now, a little later, but also Romanic style, that are the five prophets, stained windows, colored windows.
These are the oldest windows
that
in existence.
We tell the oldest windows in the whole world. We go over there, about 1140. Five prophets, Oseas, David, from the Old Testament. The colors are wonderful.
On one hand, Augsburg has its great churches, its town hall, the Renaissance's first skyscraper. In the 16th century, 100 goldsmiths worked here. But the greatest craftsmanship came at the end of the last century. Amid the gigantic machines of Augsburg's MAN Works, the company's Herr Fritz Rueff tells of the arrival in Augsburg of a man named Rudolf Diesel.
Our cooperation with Rudolf Diesel was really the most important event in the history of MAN itself. This cooperation began in 1893, when Diesel was a special engineer for refrigerating plants according to the patents of Linde and was working for Linde in Berlin. And there he had his idea of a new prime mover avoiding the faults of the good old steam engine. And the faults of the good old steam engine were an extremely low efficiency and the need of a boiler, which sometimes exploded and blew up and damaged the whole house and so on. And the new idea was an engine without any boiler, with internal combustion, and with a comparatively much higher efficiency. After getting a patent, he had to look for a firm who was prepared to cooperate, found MAN prepared, and we had an agreement with Rudolf Diesel, according to which we had to complete a first engine within 6 months. After six months, this engine was complete, but it did not run. And afterwards began what we now call development work. And another year of development led to a very efficient engine with 16% of efficiency. And this was comparatively high. It was round about twice the efficiency of the contemporary steam engine. But it was not enough, considering the difference in prices between the fuel. And so we had to continue our development work. And at the beginning of 97, we had another engine with 26% of efficiency. And this was nearly four times the efficiency of the steam engine and was enough to start production. And from then on, we produce and we sell diesel engines.
Old and new, the typically heavy German industry of today and the delicate music of the Imperial City. Before we left, we returned to the tourist office. Frau Gisa Müller talks about citizens Augsburg will always remember, a great city planner, the father of a musical prodigy, and the author of Mack the Knife.
First of all, I would like to speak about Elias Holl, our famous architect and a city planner. His greatest work is our Rathaus in the Renaissance style. It was built already in the 16th century and at this time the first skyscraper. And another family, very famous, is our Mozart family. I think not many people know that the Mozart family comes from Augsburg. His grandfather, I mean the grandfather of Mozart, Amadeus Wolfgang, lived in the Fuggerei. Otherwise, I want to speak about Bert Brecht, as he is the most famous German playwright of the 20th century. Bert Brecht was born here in Augsburg and lived many years here, down in the old town. But he is something of a black sheep of our town. His famous works are played all over the world, especially in the United States. At the moment, I am specially reminded of the Three Penny Opera.
Its heritage is based on ancient Rome. Its freedom from the independence of its craftsmen. Its rich families paved the way for musicians and painters. It's a tradition the citizens of this city won't soon forget. This has been a portrait of the headquarters city of the 24th Infantry Division, Augsburg, Germany.
This has been the Victory Division Showcase, produced through the facilities of the American Forces Network Munich by the 24th Infantry Division Information Office.
Next week, the Victory Division Showcase will present the first of a special two-part series. At the same time, the on-the-spot story of the roughest 3 days in any infantryman's training.
Slug. This is a line feed from AFN Munich to AFN Frankfurt Attention Weekend World. This is an aspect feature for broadcast 23 or 24 May from the 24th Division Information Office, Army PFC Bob Rowan reporting on an institution here in the city, a feature that is approximately 7 minutes 30 seconds in length. It follows in 5 seconds. Jim, this city of 200,000 on the Stuttgart-Munich Autobahn is not the world capital it was 400 years ago, but it does retain a legacy from those times which lives today as a modern and progressive institution. In the center of Augsburg, in the shadow of its Renaissance City Hall, is a city within a city, the oldest social settlement in the world, furnished homes for 160 families who pay an annual rent of 42 cents and who say a few prayers for their landlords each day. This unusual institution is known as the Fugerei, and its origins are interconnected with the history of the city, now 20 centuries old. When the Roman Empire was said to dominate the known world, it did not, however, include the bulk of Germany under its control. The watch on the Rhine was maintained by the Roman legions at the northernmost boundaries of civilization. But by the time of the Emperor Augustus, who decreed that all the world should pay a tax, the Romans had pushed their defenses against the northern tribes through the Alps as far as the Danube River. Thus, Augsburg became one of the first settlements in present-day Germany to come under the influence of Roman civilization and commerce, and indeed bears the name of the Emperor Augustus. As the first major city that traders met after the Brenner Pass, it became the major metropolis on the northeastern flank of the Roman Empire. This was at a time when Munich, 40 miles to the south, had not even been thought of. Augsburg's grandeur reached its height in the Renaissance through the efforts of two local merchant families. The fabulous wealth of Augsburg's Fugger and Welzer families was so staggering that in sheer monetary value, they individually outshone their contemporaries, the Medicis of Florence. Under their domination, Augsburg was made an imperial free city, independent of the powers which surrounded it. Considering that the Austrian Emperor Charles V once owed Anton Fugger 1 million florins, it's no wonder that the Augsburg merchant princes could command independence from their stronger predatory neighbors, and gather the titles of princes and counts as well. They had their finger in almost every pie of the time. They financed New World explorations, the Venetian rare spice trade, and any number of wars between kings. In fact, at one point in the 15th century, the Fugger family so controlled Atlantic trade routes that it effectively ruled South America. A century later, the Welzer family literally owned the country of Venezuela. But the powerful Fuggers were not the Medicis. They had neither the sweeping artistic vision nor the adventurous designs of their Italian neighbors. Basically, the rich Augsburgers were good, practical merchants and financiers. Their buildings were in the more conservative German Renaissance style, and their interest lay more in keeping good finances than hatching political plots. But they retained a strong medieval Christian belief that their wealth obligated them to a concern for the less fortunate as a token of gratitude. In the early 16th century, however, their enormous fortune stood in great contrast to the local population's poverty. The influx of settlers from feudal kingdoms into the free city caused the population to jump from 18,000 to 34,000 in 20 years. A serious housing problem began, especially for those 3,000 inhabitants who did not possess enough even to pay taxes. And as in any such situation, today as then, rental costs began to rise, so much so that even those of moderate wealth began to feel a pinch. So in 1510, the House of Fugger began the construction of a community of reasonably priced apartments for poor people. Finished in 1519, the walled town contained, as it does today, four gates, six alleys, 53 houses, and one church. The size of the apartments varied from 2 to 3 rooms with kitchen. All the apartments open onto the carefully laid out streets, giving them the character of homes. The Fuggerei's first tenants in the comfortable quarters were the needy residents of Augsburg, the craftsmen, day laborers, and others who did not want to beg. As time went on, the tenants changed until the area became primarily a place for retired people. But the Fugger family has kept the terms of the lease exactly the same. The rent per room in a Fuggerei apartment is 43 pfennigs a year, or a total of one Rhenish guilder, a mark 72, or 42 cents. But this is only the monetary demand from the writer of the lease, Jakob Fugger, called appropriately the Rich. In addition, he required his tenants to conduct themselves honestly and piously, and to quote the deed of foundation, every person, young and old, will say a paternoster and an Ave Maria for the founders, their parents, brothers, and all relations, and their descendants. These daily prayers for the Fugger family, still the benefactors of the Fuggeri, are said each morning at Mass in St. Marcus's Chapel, and no resident would think of missing the recitation. In the 17th century, the bricklayer Franz Mozart, forerunner of the composer, was a Fuggeri resident, and he had to abide by the same hours as the 20th century renter. Although the development stands in the center of Augsburg, it closes its gates at 10 each night. Thereafter, each resident must pay the gatekeeper 10 finnings before midnight or 20 finnings after midnight to be let in. The rules prohibit nightly amusements or occupations which might disturb the neighbors, and the resident is required to pay for anything he breaks or damages. The Fugger family, sitting in council, retains the right to cancel the right of residence on only 8 days' notice, but it has been many years since anyone has been turned out from the quiet rows of medieval houses. Today, the House of Fugger in Augsburg still administers the unique project. Although some 25% of the Fuggeri buildings were destroyed in World War II, these have now been rebuilt, with one apartment set aside for visitors, furnished exactly as the originals were 4 centuries ago. In fact, the Fuggeri is now building an additional wing to the present establishment. When finished, it will be in the same plain style as the others, but it will represent the continuing life of a project which today is as much a successful social experiment as it was an advanced idea in the minds of the Augsburg Fuggers in the 16th century. This is Army PFC Bob Rowan of the 24th Division Information Office in Augsburg, reporting for Aspect and returning you to Weekend World.
Slug, this is Victory Division Showcase for 9 June 64. Length is approximately 1330. It begins in 5 seconds.
From the island of Leyte, the rocky hills of Korea, to the mountains of Bavaria, proudly waves the banner of the 24th Infantry Division. This is the Victory Division Showcase.
This evening, the first of a special two-part series, the story of a fast-moving, wide-ranging Army training test, that yearly event for every combat unit. The first part of the story, the action.
I saw the action, plenty of it, and so did my whole platoon, the 1st Platoon of Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 19th Infantry. On a Saturday afternoon last month at Hornfels, we were halfway through the...
Platoon Sergeant Carol C. Kinney from Little Falls, Minnesota, was sitting tight at the bottom of a hill with his armored personnel carriers. The aggressors were quiet on this late afternoon. On top of the hill to his back, an artillery forward observer surveys the rugged terrain of Hohenfels.
As you can see yourself, we can see for miles, and we've got a good vantage point over the valley below us. We're approximately 100 meters above this valley. To our left front is Bravo Company, and to our right front is Alpha Company.
Down there on the right front, we waited for the aggressor. He'd been out to give us a tough time from the beginning. Incidentally, for this test, I'm not Platoon Sergeant Kinney. The company commander, Lieutenant Earl, behind me on that slope, calls me Beetle Ringo. He's the leader, Beetle George.
Beetle Ringo, this is Beetle George. What's the situation at this time, over?
Is he moving? You see where I mean? Down in this, about the same place where all those tanks pulled in.
Right at that instant, we jumped. I don't know who saw those two aggressor tracks come out of the woods first. I guess myself, Beetle George, and that observer up on the hill all at the same second.
So this is Beetle George. An aggressor movement to your front, approximately 2,400 meters. Move your direction this time. Take him under fire.
Back it up!
Apache, Arapaho, Appalachian, White Track Aztec made chase. They must have been surprised. As fast as they came out of those woods, they hightailed it back. That was all we saw of those boys for a while, but we didn't stay put long again.
All Beetle stations, this is Beetle George. Message for all stations. Be prepare to execute, move to the rear in approximately 60 minutes. Beetle Paul will move first, Beetle John second, Beetle Ringo will be the last one to move out. Or Beetle George, this is Beetle Ringo. Roger out. Commence to move now. This is Beetle Ringo. We're moving out.
Under a late afternoon sun, the 2nd of the 19th moved out for rear positions. On the way back, we passed the guys of our battalion who never stopped playing games with the aggressor forces. The armored cav platoon leader, Lieutenant Tracy Baker, at that moment was getting his outfit in position.
Two good firing positions. Generally oriented down this valley. Your front there. Well, I don't care which side of town you go on, find yourself a good... All right. Yeah, that's fine, but find yourself a good place where from out front you can't be seen, but you can see everything that's out front. You know, typical good position.
I'll be located.
Well, Sergeant Elliott can just hide his track in here and then he can put a fire team with each of you.
As we moved into our new positions, the radio inside my track was sounding off with calls from all over the battalion. The unit setting up for a night defense from where they could poise for what would happen at dawn.
One, yes, line two, yes, line three, no, line five, alpha, one, bravo, two, Charlie, four.
Beetle Ringo, this is Beetle George. Move to the ridge to your direct front.
Sleeping bag.
Jump out and caught him, Sarge. Maybe we would have got something good to eat around here.
We're in place now. One of those thick groves at Hornfels. Get some shut-eye? Well, maybe. The guys in this track take it easy. Talk about the ATT. Boy, does it get pitch dark. To add to it, well, there's the wild boar stories. Everybody who's been to Hornfels before knows them and tells them. Helps keep you awake.
The guy was sleeping in the sleeping bag next to me. Well, he thought he heard an aggressor, you know. And he thought the guy was walking around in circle. So eventually the thing came over to us and it was about, you know, right across the road. It couldn't have been more than 5 feet away from us. It was amazing, you know, and he's giving one of these grunts, you know, one of those. So we both got up and fixed our bayonets. You know, we went racing after him. And then, I don't know, he ran across the road somewhere and we lost him. But and then about a half an hour later, another one came barking through. They're huge. It was a cow. I mean, it was about that high. I bet it was 5 feet long.
Probably dangerous.
I don't know. If they were dangerous, I wouldn't have ran after them. I don't know.
Up where we were, it stayed quiet.
Beetle George, this is Beetle Ringo. Situation report. No aggressor action. The last 60 minutes.
The first light of dawn. It's hard country, but it looks kind of nice after a black night. The trouble was sneaking up on us.
Beetle Ringo, this is Beetle George, unidentified flying aircraft, approximately 2,000 meters to your rear, approaching from the north. Can you see him, over? Aggressor aircraft is attacking us, dropping chemical agents. Our protective masks are down here. All personnel are wearing them present time.
The gas attack was only the beginning that Sunday morning. Things started happening fast after that. Those artillery simulators mean that they're adding big guns to gas. So in a situation like that, there's one response. Before the umpires declare the whole outfit one big casualty, you move out for the counterattack.
Roger, all clear. Prepare to move at approximately 0-1, over.
Get out of there. Let's go down to the water.
Yeah, you get out of there.
Going the way you're going now, up over the hill, swing around in an opening and you'll see enemy to your, as you're headed now to your right.
They're sitting out there in the open, the two 114s, there are three.
4-1, this is 7-1, fire mission, over. Drop 5-0, left 5-0, fire for effect, over.
They just set up a smoke screen. They're pulling out to those woods on top of that hill.
All Beetle stations, this is Beetle George. All units prepared to move out from the assault. Beetle ring going right.
Let's go, man.
We dismounted the tracks. Before us was the large wood the aggressor had just moved out of. Beyond that, a large clearing. Overlooking that clearing was a hillside. Up there were the aggressors, their tracks and their firing positions. That was our objective.
All right, let's go, man. Okay, just hold up there till we get online. Hold up.
You're up online now, Sarge.
How much ammo you got left, Parrish?
100 rounds.
100 rounds? Okay. All right, move out.
There's a clearing now.
Hold up. All right, there they are. Hit the dirt! Move out, take cover!
Beetle George, is a Beetle ring zone. We have now moved to approximately 500 yards short of the objective. We have Papa Victor 802.
All right, Miller, fire and burst of three. All right, Miller, when he hits the ridge line to the front, then you displace forward. Displace forward. Everybody, move out!
Across the clearing. Our enemy friends were setting up on the hillside, but we were making plenty of noise. I guess the umpires thought so too. By the time we got halfway across, they were loading up in their tracks. Up the hill, and the first platoon calls this objective their own. Our 50 guys made the top just as the aggressor hightailed it around the bend.
Objective secured.
This first part of the story of an ATT starred the members of the 2nd Battalion 19th Infantry and the units attached to them during the recent exercise at Hohenfels. Platoon Sergeant Kinney was played by Sergeant Gordon Hamm. Musical arrangement by PFC Pat Burke, accompanied by PFC Frank Teldone of the 24th Division Entertainment Group. Technical production by Airman Don Major. Written and directed by Army PFC Bob Rowan. Next week, a look at the people on an Army training test.
This has been the Victory Division Showcase, produced through the facilities of the American Forces Network Munich by the 24th Infantry Division Information Office.
Slug, this is the Victory Division Showcase for airing on the 16th of June, 1964, for airing at 1745 hours following the Klemstein Bouncing in Bavaria program. The program is 1430 in duration, and we will commence with said program in approximately 5 seconds.
From the island of Leyte, the rocky hills of Korea, to the mountains of Bavaria, proudly waves the banner of the 24th Infantry Division. This is the Victory Division Showcase.
Tonight, the final chapter in the fast-moving, wide-ranging story of an ATT, Army Training Test. The roughest 3 days in any infantryman's training.
This week, we meet the men of the 1st Battalion, 19th Infantry, and the units who were attached to them last month for the Army training test on the rugged ridges and valleys of Hohenfels. We present here the unrehearsed and spontaneous voices and sounds, the men in action.
Sergeant Braylon, set two, get ready to move out.
Set two.
I know, we're going down this way and follow them up. To the right. Yeah, only we're gonna turn to the left when we get down the hill. All right. I'm gonna get this thing up as close as I can get so we can almost go right into our assault from our drop point.
That'd be a lot better. But the tanks will run a step. We don't.
The tanks are gonna be going in front of us.
We don't.
And if they move like they did last time, they'll be halfway up the hill before we get the ramps down.
When we wake with them, we're gonna have to go up close as we can.
All right, we'll go up as close as we can, drop ramps, and assault right there and try to stay on line with the tanks.
All right.
This is Charlie Company, the 2nd of the 19th, in a grove atop a Hohenfels mountain with platoon leader Lieutenant Jeffrey L. Stevens. But things don't always go according to plan. Like combat, there are always surprises.
We are subject to aggressive airstrike in 1230. Are you under cover? Over.
Airstrike in 15 minutes. Find me some good overhead cover. Probably back in here. Look back here to the right.
Real gas,
sure.
Over here?
Right.
It's CM. CM, man.
Salute it off.
There you go.
You get a whoof of that CM,
boy. CM. Yes.
Under the threat of an airstrike and possibly training gases, the company moves back into the woods and the men scatter through the underbrush for cover. We join the platoon leader in an observation dugout. In the waiting moments before the strike, we had a chance to find out about some of the winnings an ATT could bring for the soldier.
And some of the awards that are going to be given are a three-day pass beginning 3 days before our return from Hohenfels. In other words, they will go back to Augsburg 3 days early before the first capturing of a aggressor POW. First man who sights enemy aircraft, first verified sighting of enemy contact, four specialists, four promotions within the battalion for the outstanding, most outstanding performance throughout the entire ATT by a PFC, giving out Order of the Lion for the two NCOs which are judged to have performed most outstanding throughout the entire ATT, and two Orders of the Lion for the individuals who have performed the most outstanding single act during any time during the ATT.
Now, you were telling about your sergeant who found this a pretty lucrative bargain.
Yes, my first squad leader, Sergeant Smith, was in his position this morning about 2 o'clock when one of the men in his squad sighted two aggressors coming through our position from the rear. They had evidently been returning from a probe deeper within our lines and were coming out, and they were taken under fire. And with a great big open area to our front and woods to the rear, they turned around and went back. So Sergeant Smith and half the members of his squad went up and led a merry chase for about 20 minutes through the woods trying to catch him to pick up his three-day pass, but they weren't too successful. The only other contact we had that night was a small skirmish with few wild boars that came wandering through the area.
What happened there?
As they were coming through the area, they were fired upon by our ever-alert sentries who went over to collect his prisoners, and when he found out that they weren't prisoners but wild boars, he dropped his helmet and took off. I wouldn't say he dropped his helmet, he probably fell off on the way, but he was rather chagrined when he found out, too, that they were wild boars instead of aggressors, as he thought.
Elsewhere, amid the hills of Hohenfels.
This is Beetle George. What's your situation? Over.
Lieutenant Robert R. Earle, commander of Alpha Company, keeps touch with his first platoon. Motives for doing well differ. Here's Specialist Tim Chute, standing by his track during a lull in the action.
We have a special motive for doing a good job on this ATT, right?
Yeah, we do. The biggest thing is that it's for Lieutenant Earle. It's his last trip to the field with us before he rotates, and this is quite a few of our last trip out. And we do want to do a good job for Lieutenant Earle and for the platoon sergeant, Sergeant Kenny, who's done a real good job this year teaching us everything he knows and And we're just trying to do the best we can. Let Lieutenant Earl leave with a good feeling that he had a good company when he was in Germany.
I understand that this platoon is pretty highly thought of.
It is, very highly thought of. It's the best in the company.
And you've really been moving up on the line throughout this Army training test.
That's for sure, we have. We started early this morning, and we didn't stop till about noon chow, chasing the aggressors, making them move out.
Been keeping them on the run?
We sure have. I mean, we've been keeping them from coming back at us. We've been moving them from one hill to another.
In the same platoon, Staff Sergeant Floyd P. Darby assesses the ATT as he loads up his rifle magazines for the next strike.
How's this compare with those that you remember in the past?
So far, it's been all right. Pretty good.
What makes a good Army training test?
The men and the spirit, the morale they keep. That's about it. And your leaders.
Meanwhile, behind aggressor lines, a track is out, and the strangely dressed troops are busy repairing it. Comments from an umpire and Sergeant First Class William Holloway, 1st Battalion, 70th Armor.
Do you play the part of aggressor very often?
Well, occasionally. For battalion tests and different tests, we play the aggressor role.
What's it harder to be, an aggressor or the aggressed?
Well, it's probably harder to be aggressed, but it's a little more fun being the aggressor. You get to harass more people this way instead of being harassed.
It's much harder to be the aggressed unit, being aggressed against, because you don't know what's happening as the aggressor. You know when you're going to attack and when the enemy is going to attack, and you can sleep because you know that nobody's going to attack. Whereas the aggressed unit, they don't know what's going to happen, and they're up all night running around, and they never know what the story is, whereas the aggressors do. So he'll go to sleep now for a couple of hours, and then if he didn't have the track, he would.
This thing on the road, I probably will.
We got to move out.
Lieutenant Governor, what's the main job of an umpire in an ATT?
My main job is, I got two. Number one is to look and listen and evaluate.
Are you scoring? Are you actually scoring?
Right. I'll write, when this is over, I'll write up a big report on the unit, how well they did what they were supposed to have done. And number two, another job is to control them. In other words, they can only move forward so fast, or otherwise they'll overrun the aggressor. In other words, we outnumber the aggressor. If they start moving up and I know they're coming in behind the aggressor and they're going to cut the aggressor off, I'll control them by start throwing artillery fire at them, or I'll tell them there's a minefield in front of them, or I'll do something to stop them.
Another place on this mock battlefield. After a chase over two mountains, we catch up with the fast-moving armored cav platoon of the 2nd of the 19th. We get a word with Lieutenant Tracy Baker, the leader of this hot platoon.
This afternoon when I spotted you, I just saw the tank trail in the distance and a few APCs and M60 tanks whizzing down this road, leaving a big trail of dust behind. It's about the fastest thing that I've seen out in this Army training test in these 3 days. How fast do these things go?
We can push the tanks pretty close to 30 to 35 miles an hour on cross-country traveling. I've been told that they will do 55 to 60 on a good road. The 114s run about 35 mile an hour, cross country between 20 and 25 mile an hour. It was fairly rough. Otherwise, it'll cruise along right with the tanks.
We've got two armored cav platoons on the same concern, and of course, a lot of times in the field problems just for training on both of our units, we go out together, work against each other, and being as we rarely ever work together and almost always work against each other just for training, it has come up with quite a bit of rivalry between the two outfits. And we have a lot of fun. They're pretty good. Not quite as good as we are, but they're pretty good. And we have a lot of fun together. And then meeting out here on an ATT has really put some sport into the thing.
These guys had a busy morning of it. Two tankers, Sergeant Charles E. Little and Specialist Lynn A. Carpenter, give a roundup of the big event that morning.
I don't know exactly what time it was. Everything was happening so fast. But it Didn't have time to look at no watch. It was before breakfast, though. And breakfast is anywhere between 03:30 and about 10 o'clock in the morning. What time was it when Ellen and George came in their car?
It was approximately 3:30, 4 o'clock. They come up through the small wooded area when we seen them, and we run them back. They were kind of surprised. They didn't expect us to have the tanks up there. We got them running down through there, and we cut off about 9 of them from the wooded area and kept going back and forth until we got a hold of them.
One lieutenant was running off down through some brush, and I didn't notice him. I was looking for this guy that was in the open, and the driver noticed that the man was wearing a bar of some kind, and he took off after him, and we circled around him, and the guy was so pooped, he just almost dropped. But even after Specialist Carpenter grabbed him, the man still wanted to get away and try to make his escape. But the driver and Specialist Carpenter grabbed him and held on to him, and we got him back to the vehicle and got him on back to the platoon CP.
I understand that the Armored Cav platoon captured more than one prisoner this morning, though.
Well, in that one little skirmish, we captured one lieutenant and five enlisted men. And then about an hour later, we were eating breakfast and didn't quite get that down, and we were hit from our right. And went over there and captured one and turned him over to a different unit. And the infantry and the scouts captured seven or eight more. I don't know exactly how many. We had to flush, I guess there's about 20 of them out of some brush, and they were right close to the CP.
I've heard some of the guys today in the Armored Cav outfit talk about a game of Ring Around the Rosie this morning. Tell me about that, huh?
Well, while chasing these people, one person would run off in one direction, another would run off in another. And we had seven vehicles chasing these people. And one guy, maybe, or one vehicle, would get one guy hemmed off in one corner of the brush, and somebody else would get another one hemmed off, and they'd take off before we could dismount our vehicles and go get him. They just didn't want to give up.
Nobody wanted to let up on this ATT. There was action throughout the day and night for three straight days. The weather was fine, blue skies for the 3 days. Everybody was enthusiastic, and there was plenty of movement. This is the way the 2nd Battalion of the 19th Infantry fought it under combat conditions last month during their ATT among the Hohenfels Hills. This is Army PFC Bob Rowan reporting.
This has been the Victory Division Showcase, produced through the facilities of the American Forces Network Munich by the 24th Infantry Division Information Office.
The ATT Aerial 8.
We're speaking now from the headquarters command post of the 2nd Battalion, 19th Infantry, in the Hohenfels training area during their Army training test. Here now is Lieutenant Colonel George Atkinson, the battalion commander. Lieutenant Colonel Atkinson, could you tell us that what after 2 days and two nights, how the battalion is making out here on their Army training test?
Well, as we draw near the end of the test, I am still very pleased by the enthusiasm and responsiveness of the troops, which I think is a result of the interest we've generated over the past several months in taking the ATT and successfully passing it.
Well, sir, we certainly found that there's an awful lot of enthusiasm among every troop on the line. They are very excited about the mobility that the battalion has had during this Army training test. Could you tell us what you feel that their enthusiasm is generated by on this test?
Yes, I think the realism of the problem itself has a great deal to do with it, and the large number of effective aggressor forces which we're actually fighting from day to day. Basically, however, it's the high morale of the troops themselves and the interest which they have in doing well on the ATT.
We've seen these troops moving day and night
over very difficult terrain and in very difficult situations, attacking the aggressor with a lot of enthusiasm. Is this kind of training typical of the kind of training they're getting, or is this the real mark they've got to toe? In other words, is this the high point of, say, a year's training?
Yes, so although we do have similar training throughout the year, this is the high point because this is the one time during the year where every person at every level in the battalion is tested and judged by his professional equals on the job that he does as a soldier. Therefore, this is the high point of the military training year.
Sir, from what you've heard from the Empire so far, what are their judgments? Nothing yet.
Umpires are pretty non-committal. Better cut that.
Are you going to have a critique at the end of the problem?
Yes, there will be a critique the day after the problem ends, and we'll get the opinion of the umpires then and the general rating which the battalion has earned.
Could you give us an idea of what some of the major aspects of infantry combat a test like this stresses?
Well, first of all, the test stresses realism. There is a live enemy, and we must operate against him in a completely realistic manner for several days and several nights in a number of varied situations. These are not canned, and we must respond to them in a completely natural way as we would in combat. We are graded on our response. The major characteristics, I feel, so far of the problem have been its fast pace, the speed with which we have had to move over a very great deal of terrain, and the very lively showing of the aggressors who are out here in force and who have given us something to test our capabilities against.
Sir, along these lines, perhaps you could give us some particular situations which have taken place during the course of the problem in which you feel that your leaders on the line in this Army training test have shown their ability to respond to these surprise situations.
Yes, as we moved out for the problem, we ran into a very tricky situation. We thought that we were moving from our initial assembly area into a defensive position. However, the aggressor had set up a surprise position along our route of march, which our reconnaissance elements in the lead of the column discovered and reacted to very rapidly, preventing the destruction or attack of the main body. I thought this, of course, is their job. They did it in this case in a very outstanding fashion.
We also hear about the taking of a number of prisoners of war from the aggressors.
Yes, we're pretty successful there. I think we've captured all of their officers at least once and some 30-odd additional prisoners.
How about the scouting platoons and the reconnaissance platoons? Have they been successful in operating up and around the enemy lines and providing accurate intelligence information for you?
Yes, as I say, we have been in contact with the aggressor now for 2 days. Not only the CAV reconnaissance elements, but all units have put out very aggressive patrolling, have discovered a great deal of useful information, documents, equipment, prisoners, and we have reported this all back and taken advantage of it ourselves.
In your infantry career, you have undoubtedly seen great maneuvers like this done without the mechanized infantry that we have today. Perhaps you could make a comparison along that line, sir.
Yes, the mechanized infantry is a different army from the foot infantry. We operate in the mechanized infantry with such speed that you have to think on your feet, as it were, use radio for your communications, make your judgments on the basis of a hasty glance at the map, and in general, the whole tempo of the thing is increased enormously. I'd say maybe a factor of 10. This applies not only to the commanders, but to the reactions of the troops as well. They have to be highly skilled in the use of their mechanized equipment, radios, and the new weapons that we have. They're therefore much higher trained than their old foot infantry counterpart.
Sir, as regards to radio, any listen to the radio net can hear communications constantly going between any number of points, obviously dozens and dozens of points. Has the communication system with all these points in intercommunications functioned effectively during this ATT?
Yes, not once to my knowledge have we lost communications. The distances at which we're operating, though, put an extreme strain on it, and I think we're at about the limits that the present equipment can stand.
Sir, may I just ask now, after 2 days and two nights of this action, and now in your third day, the morning of your third day, how do you feel and how do the men around you feel?
Well, I'm sure as we enter the last day of this ATT that everyone feels that I do. We have done well so far, and we're going to put on a rousing climax in our final attack.
We'll be there to see it, sir. Lieutenant Colonel George Atkinson, Battalion Commander of the 2nd Battalion, 21st of the 2nd Battalion, 19th Infantry, on this Army training test in the Hohenfels training area. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Got your gun?
How about telling us what's been the most exciting moment on this Army training test for you so far in these 2 days, two nights, now in the morning of the third day?
Let's see. Most exciting moment on this trip was yesterday when an aggressor helicopter flew over.
What did they have for you?
What did they what?
Gas, machine guns, what?
They had everything. They dropped gas and we shot back. They had the works.
Did you get credit for it? For downing any of the helicopters?
Oh, myself or everybody? Well, everybody got credit for it, actually. Simulated.
Is this your first ATT?
Yeah, this is my first ATT.
Had fun?
Having a ball.
Okay, thanks.
Get up, lazy.
How about you? Let me ask you, how much sleep have you had in the course of this whole thing?
What sleep? I couldn't tell you. I wouldn't say too much. Not too much. Probably 10 hours altogether since we started.
What do? Snatch it when you can?
Right. In between radio watches and typing and running and all this stuff.
What's your rank and full name, please?
PFC Turnbull, Dick D.
Thank you. How about that, Sergeant? What's been the big moment? No? Headquarters company.
I have to think now.
Hey, really? Are there really wild boars out here?
Last night I went through a little routine. They've got some nerve, too. I guess I shouldn't use profanity.
Oh, it's all right. I'll splice it out. Just pause between the swear word and the next word.
Yeah, well, this is a little incident that last night there were the two of us were sleeping in the sleeping bag. You know, supposedly watching for aggressors.
Both in the same sleeping bag?
Well, no, we were both running the same. Not last night. That was the night before last. So, the guy that was sleeping in the sleeping bag next to me. Make sure I get that in there. Well, he thought he heard an aggressor, you know. He thought the guy was walking around in circle. So eventually the thing came over to us, and it was about, you know, right across the road. It couldn't have been more than 5 feet away from us. It was amazing, you know, and he's giving one of these grunts, you know, one of those. So we both got up and fixed our bayonets. You know, we went racing after him. And then, I don't know, he ran across the road somewhere, and we lost him. But, and then about a half an hour later, another one came barking through. They're huge. I thought it was a cow. No shit. I mean, they're really. It was about that high. I bet it was 5 feet long.
Probably dangerous.
I don't know. If they were dangerous, I wouldn't have ran after them. I don't know.
Give me your rank and full name.
My rank is Light Colonel.
Oh,
I'm not giving my name. McEntee. PFC.
What's your first name?
PFC IC, that is. James.
He's gonna have to do an awful lot of splicing.
Not me.
We were all, you know, we got into positions in the perimeter of the fence. So some clever sergeant called about four of us over. And here, this is supposed to be combat conditions, supposedly. So he says, okay, we have to build an officer's latrine. So they got a half a dozen of us out to build a screen latrine in the middle of nowhere. This, as I said, is supposed to be combat conditions. So it took us about an hour. We had to dig a hole. Some SFC gave us the dimensions of the hole. It had to be 4 foot long, not rounded at the corners. It had to be a foot and a half wide and 3 feet deep. And it couldn't be rounded out. He showed us perfectly, you know, how it, right down the sides, straight across the bottom, you know, and right down each corner. So it took us about an hour and a half to build a latrine. Of course, no one used it all night. But, well, this is really combat conditions, no doubt about that. Oh, I mean, with the bayonet in it? Oh, yeah. Usually they come in packs, though, I've heard. You know? If there's one, there's more than one around. There's a half a dozen of them.
That one last night,
they walk right down
him
the road.
Shaking in his bag.
Well, I never did see him, did you?
You should see me last night.
Oh, no.
I was
shaking like...
Who was this?
Me.
Oh, you were... You were scared, boy.
Tell them about those dressers we got.
I reached in my ammo pouch, you know? I reached in my ammo pouch and I pulled out my little blade, you know? Come on.
Yeah, that wouldn't do too much.
I was scared to death last night.
Sleep after we started talking about the different animals and... In Bavaria, and supposedly there's werewolves and... This is no shit. There's supposed to be werewolves in all of Bavaria. There's been known facts about this. God almighty, I can imagine timberwolves and werewolves.
Pennsylvania.
All Bavaria,
no doubt
about it. Werewolves.
Come out at night.
So this guy's from Mexico that I was talking, he starts talking to me about black magic. He actually want to become invisible? He says, cut off a guy's cat's ear and bury him at midnight and water him for 30 days at midnight? What the? Get down. There's something to that. There's no doubt about that, about witchcraft. Positive.
Yeah, they're all good cats. They're holding a Dracula or something, right? Supposedly.
Dr. Frank.
Oh.
You guys been guarding any POWs?
Yeah, we guarded a few of them. We had two tracks captured yesterday. We took them up by the mess hall and fell asleep with them. I mean, well, we had to wait for the lieutenant to clear them and then we let them go again.
Oh, they go back to the lines.
Yeah, but they can't use the tracks anymore because we had the numbers of them in that.
We was guarding a whole company of them. Commanding officer, executive officer, all the whole company. A tank run them down. They had no choice but to give up.
Yeah, there's two tracks yesterday caught by the tank.
Tank company.
Tank company.
What ranks were they?
What?
What ranks were these POWs?
Well, it was, you couldn't tell what their ranks were, but you knew that one was a sergeant there and another one was a...
CO.
No, the two tracks that we had yesterday.
Oh, you did, yeah, but they had this, when I went over there yesterday morning, I had the CO and the second lieutenant.
We had numbers 25 and 28 yesterday.
We had them all over there, the whole fucking company.
There's about 20, 30 of them.
How'd they get
over there? Yeah, a tank ran down. They was in a ditch, yeah,
They
threw tear gas on the tank, see? And the guys in the tank got mad, and they jumped clear across the ditch and run them down through the field, and they had no choice. They had to give up. The tank, they'd run over.